So turn with me this morning to Exodus chapter 2. Exodus chapter 2. Moving right along. If you're keeping track, this is part 56 of Old Testament history. My brief overview of Old Testament history. It just dawned on me the other day that 56 weeks is a month longer than 1 year. So we're not moving as quickly as I thought we might, but I think it's been a fruitful study nonetheless. So we'll just continue meandering through the Old Testament, learning as much as we can along the way. As we learned last Lord's Day, in an effort to stop the continued growth of the Israelites in Egypt, Pharaoh ordered that every male child born to any of the Hebrew women be put to death. Now, initially, this order was given to the midwives who served the Hebrew women. But when that became problematic, when they began to disobey, Pharaoh commanded all the people of Egypt to be on the lookout for male Hebrew newborns. And when they were found, they were to throw the babies into the Nile. Now, why was Pharaoh so paranoid in this regard? Well, it's because he feared that the Israelites would one day grow strong enough to displace him as king and assume control of all of Egypt. After all, this is what he had done himself. If, as we think is true, if he was one of the Hyksos kings, meaning that he was Semitic himself and had invaded Egypt and taken over, if this is true, then there's reason for him to be paranoid, to think that others might come and do the same thing, right? Anyway, we resume our reading this morning at verse 1 of chapter 2. Read it with me. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Now, first things first, just stop here for a minute. Who were Moses' parents? Well, in Exodus chapter 6 and verse 20, we learned that their names were Amram and Jochebed. In Exodus 7, verse 7, we also learn that Moses had a brother named Aaron, who was 3 years his senior. In Exodus 15, 20, we read about Moses' sister Miriam. So, again, what do we know about Moses' family, and especially with their association with the tribe of Levi? Well, it's important to understand at this time the tribe of Levi was nothing really special. You know, the tribe of Levi would later be given the distinction as the priestly tribe. The Levitical priesthood will spring from the tribe of Levi. But at this point, it's still a relatively small clan of those who were descended from Jacob's third son, one of the sons that he had with Leah. It wouldn't be until much later that we see them coming into prominence. Now, as for Amram and Jochebed, what do we know about them in terms of whether or not they were God-fearing Hebrews? Well, if you look over to Hebrews 11, and I don't know about you, but I'm so grateful for this hall of faith that we see in Hebrews 11, because there are times like this when it's very helpful in explaining things about Old Testament figures that are not explained in the Old Testament itself. So, again, a very helpful thing here. Hebrews 11:23, we read this. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents. And again, this is a very strong indication that they had faith enough to hide him and trust God for the outcome. Because they saw that he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. It's well said that faith is really the only antidote to fear. if you are a person of faith, if you truly believe that God is in control of every molecule that exists, then you really have no reason to fear anything. And I'm sure this was very pronounced in the lives of those through whom God was working most intensely to bring about his redemptive plan. Amram and Jochebed were obviously given a special measure of faith to live during this particular time when having babies as a Hebrew woman was very precarious, very dangerous. And it was because of the faith of Moses' parents that they weren't afraid of the king's edict. They knew that as long as they remained faithful to their God, he would protect them from the evil of their pagan captors. And man, is that true. As we're going to see in just a minute, God almost goes overboard in the way that he provides for Amram and Jochebed. And I think it unfolds that way as a message to us that if we place our trust in God during the most difficult parts of our own lives, God will go above and beyond anything we're capable of thinking or even asking in order to sustain us. Our problem is we just don't generally have that kind of faith. And I say that lovingly. I say that including myself. I've admitted in all transparency before, I tend to worry a lot about various things. I know I shouldn't. I know Philippians 4, 6, and 7 better than most people. I've studied it upside down, sideways, backwards, forwards. I know that we're not to be anxious for anything, but with prayer and supplication, make our requests known unto God, and that peace that passes all understanding will be ours in Christ Jesus. I know that. But what I know and what I know are often two different things. It's part of the human condition, right? But I do very firmly believe that when the chips are down, when things do get particularly dangerous, when things get very unsettling for us, we can tap into that faith and realize that God will take care of us, right? And I think this is what Amram and Jochebed are doing here. They're tapping into this faith. They're out of options. I mean, what do? You're a Hebrew woman. You have a baby. You know that all the Hebrew babies are being killed. The male babies are being killed. What do you do? Well, it's fascinating. Here, they actually obey the edict. What did Pharaoh say? If you find any Hebrew baby boys, put them in the Nile. Okay. He didn't say anything about putting them in a wicker basket that's got tar and pitch all around it and inside of it, quite comfy, right? So again, I believe they were led by the Lord. Instead of circumventing the edict, instead of being disobedient to the powers appointed over them, they obeyed. And they did so with full trust that God would take care of it. Well, what's particularly fascinating about this from our current historical perspective, as Kyle and Delitzsch note here, whilst Pharaoh was urging forward the extermination of the Israelites, God was preparing their emancipator. If you look behind the scenes, as we can only do now, they didn't know this then, but God is not only preventing Pharaoh from getting his wish and killing every Hebrew child, just as in the case of Christ himself, God's preparing Moses to be these people's emancipator. Now, what are we to make of what Moses says here with regard to his mother's hiding him for 3 months when she saw that he was beautiful? Does that mean that if Moses was an ugly baby that she would have just thrown him into the Nile? Thrown him to the crocodiles? No. No. This phrase doesn't have as much to do with Moses' appearance, although that's probably true. I mean, every mom, you know, you have a baby, and I'm going to be perfectly honest, it can be the ugliest baby ever born, and mom's like, isn't he or she so beautiful? I know, I get a lot of flack from my family for this, but don't ever ask me that. I mean, I'm sure the child will grow into their own, and become very handsome, very beautiful. But come on, sometimes some babies that are born, they're born, they look like they're 87 years old. And from the moment of their birth, they look like they haven't had a good night's sleep in forever, which they probably haven't. But you get the idea. Babies can be ugly. Just being real. Just keeping it real here. And I say that to explain the fact that Jochebed didn't have this fascination with her son just because he was a handsome baby. Just because he was a delight to her. It goes deeper than that. And this is why we should all think this way. While I might think some babies are not as attractive as other babies, and there are some babies that come out and they're just like, wah, they're, you know, just beautiful children. Again, keeping it real. But what transcends all that is the reality that every child born is a blessing from God. What transcends that is the realization that you as a mother and father have brought into this world another image bearer of God. And in that sense, the baby is beautiful. All babies are beautiful in God's sight because they are recreations of fellow image bearers of God. Babies are a sure indication that God has not given up on humanity. And what a blessing that is. You know, we bemoan the fact that our kids are going to grow up in a world much different than the world that we grew up in. And it is horrifying. But do we not trust God to navigate them through every twist and turn of life? And if it please Him to save them and draw them to Himself and continue the legacy of Christianity within your own family? And sure, we can trust God for that. And we should. But I want you to understand that when Amram and Jochebed looked at their little son Moses, it wasn't because, well, you know, he's a pretty baby, so we're going to keep him. That's not at all what happened. As a matter of fact, if you go to Acts chapter 7, of all places, you know, Acts chapter 7 is also a really helpful book or chapter in the New Testament because it shines a lot of light on the Old Testament that is not necessarily as clear as we would like for it to be in the Old Testament. Stephen is recalling, making his defense, as it were, before the high priest. And among other things, this is what he says. Look at verse 17. Acts 7:17. Stephen says, "As the time of the promise was approaching, which God had assured to Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt, until there arose another king over Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph." That sounds familiar, right? This is exactly what we've been studying since the beginning of Exodus here. "It was he who took shrewd advantage of our race and mistreated our fathers so that they would expose their infants and they would not survive. It was at this time that Moses was born," and get this, "and he was lovely in the sight of God, and he was nurtured 3 months in his father's home." So here in our text this morning, we should read the end of verse 2 as, "When she," Jochebed, "saw that Moses was beautiful in the sight of God, she hid him for 3 months." And again, this takes away any superficiality. It really recuses Jochebed from the accusation that she might just be keeping the baby around because she liked the way the baby looked. No, she recognized by faith that this child was beautiful in God's eyes. And so she hid him for 3 months. In some way that we can't completely understand on the basis of her God-given faith, Moses' mother knew that there would be something special about this particular child. Of course, as a mother, you know, she likely would have done the same thing for any of her children, but the language here again suggests that she had at least some inkling that Moses was destined for some kind of divine duty. I believe there are at least two really important takeaways from just these opening two verses. Number one, as a child of God, we have no reason to fear the Pharaohs in our life. I believe that's an important takeaway here. We can be like Amram and Jochebed. No matter what befalls us, no matter what laws are created, no matter how inconvenient the government makes it to live as a believer, we need not fear the Pharaohs that are appointed over us. Why? Because faith drives out fear. Or it should. Number two, we can and should place all of our children into God's care. Just as we are who we are by God's grace alone, we can be comforted by the fact that our children will be what they are destined to be by God's grace. You know, I know that there are a lot of parents with unsaved children, wayward children, children who have not lived up to the training and the teaching that they received in their younger days. But see, here's the thing. We have no idea what God has in terms of their destiny for them. We have no idea that 10, 15, 20 years after our own death, they become veritable powerhouses for the Lord God, on fire for Christ, dying martyrs' deaths, doing great things in the name of Christ. Well, it sure doesn't look like it from my perspective. They're out there doing whatever, and they're wayward, and they're, you know, thank God that they're still alive. Because as long as they're alive, there remains that hope that when they're old, they won't depart from what they were taught when they were young. Now, that's not a guarantee. But is that not hope enough to cling to? That our God, who has been so faithful to us, will also extend that faithfulness to our children one day? See, our problem is we want to see it now. Our problem is we don't want God to do whatever He's doing. You know, it's quite possible, probable, that whatever God is doing in the lives of these unbelieving kids of yours is all intended to bring them to where He is going to bring them eventually. Leave it to Him. Stop worrying. Stop fretting. Stop insisting in an offhanded way that you know better than God. Well, I mean, if I were God, I'd just save my children and get it over with. You know, that's my desire. God doesn't operate according to your desire. He operates according to His good pleasure alone. And He tells us to be content with it. He tells us to leave it to Him. Do you not sleep well at night knowing that He's got this? I mean, at the very least, lay your head down at night and pray, Lord, I am trusting that even though I don't understand this, You've got this. Right? So here in our text this morning, we're seeing something really special in terms of trust. And I think we can and should learn from that. Now note this as well. Entrusting our children to God's care doesn't mean that we adopt a hands-off approach to parenting. It doesn't mean that we simply let go and let God do what He will without any intervention on our part. To the contrary, we are repeatedly taught throughout Scripture about the importance of raising up our children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. How do you do that? You teach them and you train them in the way that should go so that when they're older, they won't depart from it. But more importantly, you model that for them. I've said this before, I'll say it again. You realize that as parents, for most of your children's younger days, they view you as God's representative. And I know, especially in my own generation, that many of us were raised with the attitude, don't do as I do as I say. Right? How many of you had a dictatorial father or mother like that who would always say, don't follow me as an example, you just do what I tell you to do? That is straight from the darkest pit of hell. Don't ever tell your children, just do it because I say to do it. Model for them what it means to do it. How can you tell your children that the importance of being faithful to the Lord if you're not being faithful? You can't. What kind of models are you presenting to them? How do they view God? I tell you this, they're going to view God through you as the lens. Right, wrong, or indifferent, that's just the way it happens. Especially fathers. They're going to look at you as kind of a proto-God before they come to know Him themselves. They're going to learn everything that they need to know about God from you, or they're not. You understand that? Well, wait a minute, Pastor. I thought God's sovereign in salvation. He is. Well, I thought, about, you know, God's going to save him if he's going to save him. He's not going to save him if he's not going to save him. That's all true. But here's the thing. You're building a foundation for them. You're giving them the platform that will help them to grow in a very responsible way. They'll never love the Lord as much as they should unless you're loving the Lord as much as you hope they love the Lord. I hope that makes sense. Because we need to do a better job, all of us, of parenting our children. Training them up, giving them that moral foundation upon which to build, should God be pleased to save them. Moses' parents understood this, which is why they got Moses a wicker basket and they covered it inside and out with tar and pitch. This is kind of symbolic of what I'm saying. They didn't just throw Moses in the Nile and say, well, the Lord will spontaneously teach him how to swim. Right? They didn't just toss him in the Nile and say, well, he's the Lord's now. No, they did stuff. They got a basket and they covered it with pitch and tar inside and out to make sure that they were doing their dead level best to ensure his safety. You see that symbiosis between us and God? God will never bless you to the extent that you might be blessed unless you participate. Christianity is not a spectator sport. We're called to do. We're called to work. Not for our salvation, but on the basis of our having been saved by God. As one commentator noted, the faith that was possessed by Amram and Jochebed was a faith that works. Jochebed's attention to detail is a beautiful illustration of the connection which should always exist between the diligent use of means and a pious trust in providence. Instead of sitting down in sullen despair or passive dependence on divine interposition to do all the work, everything is done which can be done by human agency. Or as another commentator observed, this is a beautiful picture of God's sovereignty and human responsibility working side by side. Now, this is where things get really interesting. Does this wicker basket, covered inside and out with tar and pitch, does that remind you of something? Noah's Ark, right? What's especially fascinating about this is that the same Hebrew word is used for Noah's Ark and this little wicker basket. And it's used only twice in the entire Old Testament. Think there's a correlation there? Likely so. The word is taba. It refers to Noah's Ark 26 times in different places. When I say twice, I mean just in relation to the ark and the basket, not just two times. But 26 times it refers to the ark, twice it refers to this little small basket. And what's more, both of these box-like structures have one thing important in common. They were meant to preserve life. They were meant to stop the possibility of drowning. Now again, we can't be hard and fast on that and say, yep, that's, you can't be dogmatic and say, yep, that's a picture of the ark. But there are similarities there where, again, God uses the same means to protect those of his choosing. In the case of Noah's family, they were preserved so the human race would continue. You know, without Noah and his family, without those eight souls being saved when the rest of the world was drowned in the deluge, the flood, the human race would have been cut off. There would be no more human existence. In Moses' case, little baby Moses was preserved to ensure the eventual deliverance of the Israelites, which would one day guarantee the arrival of Messiah himself. Verse 4. His sister, this would be Miriam, stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Now again, here we have another example of how God's sovereignty and human responsibility often work side by side. There's no doubt, as we've just talked about, there's no doubt that Jochebed and Amram trusted God impeccably. But she likely told Miriam to go and be on the lookout to see what would happen to the wicker basket once the baby was placed inside. And, I mean, think about it. What could have happened? You place a little baby in a wicker basket. I mean, you're not a boat maker. You don't know if it's going to leak or if it's going to turn over or if it's going to get stuck in the reeds 5 feet from where you dropped it in the river or if crocodiles are going to come and take a bite out of it or if bandits are going to steal the baby to sell it like they would back during that day. You don't know. There's all kinds of things that could have happened. So Miriam is told, we're not told that she's told, but we can only surmise that she's part of the plan. She's told, hey, go and see, make sure that this gets clear of our own little compound here, and then see what happens. Now, you think this was Jochebed's idea? No. This is also divinely inspired. How do we know? We know because of what happens after this. Now, let me just say this too. Could this indicate that Jochebed's faith was imperfect? Yes. How do I know that? Because I am the possessor of an imperfect faith as well. Anybody here have a perfect faith? I mean, Jesus pretty much tells us that we don't have a perfect faith. Even his immediate disciples didn't have a perfect faith. In fact, he made them all charter members of the O Ye of Little Faith Club. You know, he would go away. He'd say, okay, wait here and be on the lookout. He would go pray for, you know, a little bit of time and come back and they're all snoozing. You know, and then he has to lecture them about if you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could say to that mountain, be uprooted and jump into the sea. The point being, we don't have the kind of faith that we could have if we trusted wholly in God's provision. Jochebed's the same way. You know, she's trusting God, but she's also going to put Miriam as a lookout to make sure things go the way they should. Instead of the basket being stopped in the reeds, maybe Miriam could go over and dislodge it, and put it on its way, whatever the case might be. But let me just also point out the providence of God that's on display here. Where did the basket stop? Well, it stopped. It just happened to stop in the reeds that were at the exact spot that Pharaoh's daughter would bathe. When did it stop? Well, we're told that it stopped not long before she and her maidens arrived. I mean, it's almost like it was a predetermined, like, little bus stop, you know? Moses stops in his little wicker basket, and here come the maids along with Pharaoh's daughter. Why did it stop? Because God intended for Moses to infiltrate the Egyptian court and work as the Israelites' emancipator, first from the inside, and then as one of their own. And don't miss the other obvious providences here. Verse 6, when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying, and she had pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Then his sister, Miriam, Now get this, she's not just watching from a distance. She has followed this little basket as it floats down the river to where it stopped, and she's there. And she says to Pharaoh's daughter, "I've got an idea. Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women?" You get where this is going, right? "So that she may nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Who's that? Jochebed. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. Now we know why Miriam was watching this whole thing unfold. First, Pharaoh's daughter just happened to be the one to find Moses. Not only that, God had given her a heart, not like her father's, but he had given her a heart of compassion. And when she recognized that Moses was a Hebrew baby, what should she have done? She should have lifted him from the basket, thrown him out into the Nile. But she had pity on him, even as a Hebrew baby. Then, as it just happened, Miriam's there. "You want me to go get a nurse? I know a good nurse from among the Hebrew women who can nurse this child for you." Pharaoh's daughter just happens to say, "What a great idea. Do that. And not only do that, but keep the baby. Keep nursing the baby. Raise the baby for a time. And oh, by the way, I'm going to pay you." I mean, is this not God's work on grand display? I mean, can you not see in every warp and woof of this fabric that's being weaved the providence of God? You take a poor, destitute family like Amram and Jochebed's family, and you have her have a Hebrew baby that should be killed. Oh, by the way, they're going to put it in a basket, send it down the Nile in perfect obedience to the edict. It's going to be found by Pharaoh's daughter, who's then going to return the child to be nursed by his own mother, except now she's going to be paid for it. You talk about, you know, I can't help but think that God laughs, right, at our futile efforts to displace him or to do that which is not in accordance with his will. Pharaoh thought he was doing something, you know, "I'll get him. Just like Herod, I'll show them. I'll thwart God's plan if this is a real thing. This baby won't live." And his own daughter adopts him and then pays his mother to raise him. So Jochebed's old. Not too old, but we know that she was probably fairly mature. She's told to take the child away and nurse him. You'll be paid for it. And not only that, the king's daughter is paying Jochebed from Pharaoh's own treasury. Verse 10, the child grew. She brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses and said, "Because I drew him out of the water." Now, how old was Moses when he was given to Pharaoh's daughter? We can't be sure. Some scholars believe, though, that Moses would have been allowed to stay with Amram and Jochebed until puberty. Not just until he was weaned, but until puberty. Why do we think that? Well, we don't really think that. We kind of know that because, as I've said before, according to the Egyptians, you were useless until you were able to work. There would have been no need for Moses to have been given to Pharaoh's daughter as an infant. She didn't want an infant. She didn't want to care for a baby. She didn't want to care for a toddler. She didn't want to care for a child that had not yet entered school age, which during this time, somewhere around 10, 11, 12 years old would be the time when they would be seen as useful. And this was true even among Pharaoh's family, because Moses was then given to Pharaoh's daughter, and he was trained in whatever he was training to do. I think in the film, The Ten Commandments, he was an architect or a surveyor or something like that. We really don't know. The Hebrew's kind of murky there. But we do know that he grew to such prominence that he was an overseer. Now, how do we know that? Well, we know that because he went out to his brethren, we're told, when he'd grown up, and looked on their hard labors. He was a supervisor of sorts by this time. Now, Moses' name is really interesting. She said she named him Moses because I drew him out of the water. The name doesn't mean I have drawn him out of the water. It just means to draw out, to pull out, to deliver from anything. And that's what makes the name so poignant, because not only was he pulled out from certain death, delivered from certain death, he would also be the one to deliver his people from certain death. And so even then, Pharaoh's daughter is prophesying without even knowing it. Well, verse 11. Now, it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on the hard labors. This is another important indicator of how old Moses is at this point. By grown up, this is probably the point at which his training is over. How many years that took would depend on the job that he was given. But he's now serving in the capacity that he's been training for. And again, we're not told what it was, but we do get the indication that he's an overseer at this point. Another important point to note is that according to Hebrews 11, 24, and 25, as a man of God-given faith himself, Moses never lost his sense of kinship to his people. And this was important, right? What might have happened to Moses had he simply been adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, trained in Pharaoh's court, taken on an Egyptian job? Maybe he's a surveyor, maybe he's an architect, maybe he's just an overseer of the laborers, who knows? But what might have happened during these years of training and indoctrination and all of the things that could have happened to him? Well, he could have forgotten his brethren. He could have forgotten where he came from. He could have forgotten that he was a Hebrew himself. That's very possible. We see it happening all the time with kids who go off to college today, right? Kids, you know, even kids raised in Christian homes can go to state colleges, secular colleges, and come back and they're flaming liberals who don't know anything but think they know everything, right? And so we see that kind of thing happening, but God preserves Moses. God instills in Moses an affinity for his own kin. He reminds him constantly that these are his people that he's putting into hard labor. And how good is it of God to allow Moses to spend his formative years with his own mother? During that time, Moses was undoubtedly, Moses was taught about the one true God. Moses was taught about the importance of faith in this one true God. Moses was taught about the promise made to Abraham, Isaac, and his great-grandfather Jacob. He was well aware at this time, I believe, that something was going to happen. I don't think he knew that he would play a part in it at this time. But he knew that something important was going to happen, or else God's promise would not come true. His people are enslaved. How can this promise come true? We're not even in a land of our own. We're not in the promised land. We're in Egypt. How can it be that God's going to make good on this promise? And he's about to find out. And he's about to find out that God's going to make good on these promises through him. How is he going to find out? Well, again, if you go back to Hebrews 11, 24 and 25, we read, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Not only did he have an affinity for his Hebrew brethren, but at some point his mind changed And he said, you know, I would much rather suffer with them than lead them, than lord my position over them. Now, when did that transition take place? Well, keep reading in our text at verse 11. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. He went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And he said to the offender, why are you striking your companion? But he said, who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and said, surely the matter has become known. What happened next? We have to come back next time. Stay tuned for the rest of the story. But you can see God's hand at work even in this. This killing of this Egyptian was sovereignly orchestrated to propel Moses himself to that next level. You know, it's quite possible that Moses, being the human being that he was, it's quite possible that Moses could have begun to enjoy his position as overseer. You know, it's no big thing if Hebrews are being beat. I'm an Egyptian. I enjoy all the pleasures and all the privileges of being a son of Pharaoh himself, a grandson. I can just keep my mouth shut and enjoy this for the rest of my days. And he could have. He very well could have. But his kinship with his own people was so great that when he saw one of them being beaten, that was the last straw that God used to push him to a place that I doubt at the time he really wanted to go. I mean, you can almost hear the uh-oh here, right? You know, how many of you as a kid, maybe even as an adult, you've done something that you think you're all alone and you think nobody's watching, and you've done something and then you realize somebody saw you? Dun, 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 right? Want to get away? That sort of thing just makes your blood run cold, doesn't it? Moses is experiencing that same kind of thing. What do you do? I mean, he's going to just run away from it all. And then that's only going to steal his resolve even more to come back and free his people, because God's not going to let him run away. I think there's a lesson for us there too. God's not going to let you run away from your problems. You're going to pay some type of price at some point. Will it be tomorrow? Will it be the next day? We don't know. But isn't it better to simply obey? Do what God requires of us and live in the light of His good pleasure as opposed to constantly being at war with Him? I say yes. And that's a lesson Moses himself is going to learn too in the coming passages.